The Statement of Randolph Carter. I repeat to you gentlemen that your inquisition is fruitless. Detain me here forever if you will. Confine or execute me if you have a victim to propagate the illusion you call justice. But I can say no more than I have already. Everything that I can remember I've told with perfect candor. Nothing has been distorted or concealed, and if anything remains vague, it's only because of the dark cloud which has come over my mind. That cloud and nebulous nature of the horrors which brought it upon me. Again, I say, I do not know what became of Harley Warren, though I think, almost hope, that he is in peaceful oblivion, if there be anywhere so blessed a thing. It's true that I have for 5 years been his closest friend, and a partial sharer of his terrible researches into the unknown. I will not deny, though my memory is uncertain and indistinct, that this witness of yours may have seen us together, as he says, on the Gainesville Pike, walking towards Big Cypress Swamp, at 11:30 on that awful night. That we bore electric lanterns, spades, and a curious coil of wire with attached instruments, I will even affirm. For these things all played a part in the single hideous scene which remains buried into my shaken recollection. But of what followed, and of the reason I was found alone and dazed on the edge of the swamp the next morning, I must insist that I know nothing save what I have told you over and over again. You say to me that there is nothing in that swamp or near which could form the setting of that frightful episode. I reply that I knew nothing beyond what I saw. Vision or nightmare it may have been. Vision or nightmare, I fervently hope it was. Yet it is all that my mind retains of what took place in those shocking hours after we left the sight of my men, and why Harley Warren did not return. He or his shade, or some nameless thing I cannot describe, alone, can tell. As I said before, the weird studies of Harley Warren were well known to me, and to some extent shared by me. Of his vast collection of strange rare books on forbidden subjects, I have read all that are written in the languages of which I am master. But these are few as compared to those in those languages I cannot understand. Most, I believe, are in Arabic, and the fiend-inspired book which he brought on the end, the book which he carried in his pocket out of the world, was written in characters whose like I never saw elsewhere. Warren would never tell me just what was in that book. As to the nature of our studies, must I again say that I no longer retain full comprehension? Seems to me rather merciful that I do not, for they were terrible studies which I pursued more through reluctant fascination than through actual inclination. Warren always dominated me, and sometimes I feared him. I remember how I shuddered at his facial expression on the night before that awful happening, when he talked so incessantly of his theory, why certain corpses never decay, but rest firm and fat in their tombs for thousands of years. But I do not fear him now, for I suspect that he has known horrors beyond my ken. Now I fear for him. Once more I say that I have no clear idea of what subject on that night. Certainly I had much to do with something in the book which Warren carried with him, that ancient book in undecipherable characters which had come to him from India a month before. But I swear I do not know what it was that we expected to find. Your witness says he saw us only 11:30 on the Gainesville Pike, headed for Big Cypress Swamp. This is probably true, but I have no distinct memory of it. The picture seared into my soul as one unseen only, and of the hour must have been long after midnight, for a waning crescent moon was high in the vaporous heavens. The place was an ancient cemetery, so ancient I trembled at the manifold signs of immemorial years. It was in a deep, damp hollow, overgrown with rank grass, moss, and curious creeping weeds, and filled with vague stench, which my idle fancy associated absurdly with rotten stone. On every hand were the signs of neglect and decrepitude, and I seemed haunted by the notion that Warren and I were the first living creatures to invade a lethal silence of centuries. Over the valley's rim, a wan, waning crescent moon peered through the noisome vapors that seemed to emanate from unheard of catacombs, and by its feeble, wavering beams I could distinguish a repellent array of antique slabs, urns, cenotaphs, and mausoleum facades, all crumbling, moss-grown, and moisture-stained, and partly concealed by the gross luxuriance of unhealthy vegetation. My first vivid impression of my own presence in this terrible necropolis concerns the act of pausing with Warren before a certain half-obliterated sepulchre, and throwing down some burdens which we seemed to have been carrying. I now observed that I had with me an electric lantern and two spades, whilst my companion was supplied with a similar lantern and a portable telephone outfit. No word was uttered, for the spot and the task seemed known to us, and without delay we seized our spades and commenced to clear away the grass, weeds, and drifted earth from the flat, archaic mortuary. After uncovering the entire surface, which consisted of three immense granite slabs, we stepped back some distance to survey the charnel scene, and Warren appeared to make some mental calculations. Then he returned to the sepulchre, and using his spade as a lever, sought to pry up the slab, laying nearest to the stony ruin, which may have been the monument in its day. He did not succeed, and motioned to me to come to his assistance. Finally, our combined strength loosed the stone, which we raised and tipped to the side. The removal of the slab revealed a black aperture, from which rushed an effluence of miasmal gases, so nauseous that we started back in horror. After an interval, however, we approached the pit again and found the exhalations less unbearable. Our lanterns disclosed the top of a flight of stone steps, dripping with some detestable ichor of the inner earth, and bordered by moist walls encrusted with nitre. And now, for the first time, my memory records verbal discourse, Warren addressing me at length in his mellow tenor tone, a voice singularly unperturbed by our awesome surroundings. "I'm sorry to have to ask you to stay on the surface," he said, "but it would be a crime to let anyone with your frail nerves go down there. You can't imagine, even from what you have read and from what I've told you, the things I shall have to see and do. It's fiendish work, Carter, and I doubt if any man without ironclad sensibilities could ever see it through and come up alive and sane. I don't wish to offend you, and heaven knows I'd be glad to have you with me, but the responsibility is in a certain sense mine, and I couldn't drag a bundle of nerves like you down a probable death or madness. I tell you, you can't imagine what the thing is really like, but I promise to keep you informed over the telephone of every move. You see, I've enough wire here to reach the center of the earth and back." I can still hear, in memory, those coolly spoken words, and I can still remember my remonstrances. I seemed desperately anxious to accompany my friend to those sepulchral depths, yet he proved inflexibly obdurate. At one time he threatened to abandon the expedition if I remained insistent, a threat which proved effective, since he alone held the key to the thing. All this I can remember, though I no longer know what manner of thing we sought. After he had obtained my reluctant acquiescence in his design, Warren picked up the reel of wire and adjusted the instruments. At his nod, I took one of the latter and seated myself upon an aged, discolored gravestone by the newly uncovered aperture. Then he shook my hand, shouldered the coil of wire, and disappeared within that indescribable ossuary. For a minute, I kept sight of the glow of his lantern and heard the rustle of the wire as he laid it down after him. But the glow soon disappeared abruptly, as if a turn in the stone staircase had been encountered, and the sound died away almost as quickly. I was alone. It bound the unknown depths by those magic strands whose insulated surface lay green beneath the struggling beams of that waning crescent moon. In lone silence, that hoary and deserted city of the dead, my mind conceived most ghastly fantasies and illusions, and the grotesque shrines and monoliths seemed to assume a hideous personality, a half-sentience. Amorphous shadows seemed to lurk in the darker recesses of the weed-choked hollow, and to flit, as in some blasphemous ceremonial procession past the portals of the moldering tombs in the hillside, shadows which could not have been cast by that pallid, peering crescent moon. I constantly consulted my watch by the light of the electric lantern, and listened with feverish anxiety at the receiver of the telephone, but for more than a quarter of an hour heard nothing. Then a faint clicking came up from the instrument, and I called down to my friend in a tense voice. Apprehensive as I was, it was nevertheless unprepared for the words that came up from that uncanny vault in accents more alarmed and quivering than any I had ever heard before from Harley Warren. He who had so calmly left me a little while previously now called from below in a shaky whisper more portentous than the loudest shriek. "God, if you could see what I'm seeing!" I couldn't answer. Speechless, I could only wait. Then came the frenzied tone again. "Carter, it's terrible, monstrous, unbelievable!" This time my voice did not fail me, and I poured into the transmitter a flood of excited questions. Terrified, I continued to repeat, "Warren, what is it? What is it?" Once more came the voice of my friend, still hoarse with fear, now apparently tinged with despair. I can't tell you, Carter. It's too utterly beyond thought. I dare not tell you. No man could know it and live. Great God, I never dreamt of this." Stillness again saved my now incoherent torrent of shuddering inquiry. Then the voice of Warren in a pitch of wilder consternation. "Carter, for the love of God, put back the slab and get out of this if you can. Quick, leave everything else and make for the outside. It's your only chance. Do as I say and don't ask me to explain." I heard, yet was only able to repeat my frantic questions. Around me were the tombs of the darkness and the shadows. Below me, some peril beyond the radius of the human imagination. But my friend was in greater danger than I. Though my fear, I felt a vague resentment that he should deem me capable of deserting him under such circumstances. More clicking. Then, after a pause, a piteous cry from Warren.
"Beat it! For God's sake, put the slab back and beat it, Carter!"
Something in the boyish slang of my evidently stricken companion unleashed my faculties. I formed and shouted a resolution. "Warren, brace up! I'm coming down!" But at this offer, the tone of my order changed to a scream of utter despair.
"Don't! You can't understand. It's too late. And my fault. Put back the slab and run. There's nothing else you or anyone can do now."
The tone changed again, this time acquiring a softer quality, as of hopeless resignation. Yet it remained tense through anxiety for me,
quick. Before it's too late.
I tried not to heed him, tried to break through the paralysis which held me, and to fulfill my vow to rush down to his aid. But his next whisper found me set still and hurled inert in the chains of stark horror.
Carter, hurry. It's no use. You must go. Better one than two. The slab.
A pause. More clicking. Then the faint voice of Warren.
Nearly over now. Don't make it harder. Cover up those damned steps and run for your life. You're losing time. So long, Carter. I won't see you again.
Here Warren's whisper swelled into a cry that gradually rose to a shriek fraught with all the horror of the ages.
Curse these hellish things, legions! My God, beat it! Beat it! Beat it!
After that was silence. I know not how many interminable eons I sat stupefied, whispering, muttering, calling, screaming into that telephone. Over and over, through these eons, I whispered and muttered and muttered and called and shouted and screamed. Warren! Warren, answer me! Are you there? And then there came to me the crowning horror of it all. The unbelievable, unthinkable, almost unmentionable thing. I've said that eons seemed to elapse after Warren shrieked forth his last despair and warning, and that my only cries now broke the hideous silence. But after a while there was a further clicking in the receiver, and I strained my ears to listen. Again, I called down, "Warren, you there?" And in answer, heard the thing which has brought this cloud over my mind. I do not try, gentlemen, to account for that thing, that voice, nor can I venture to describe it in detail, since the first words took away my consciousness and created a mental blank which reached the time of my awakening in the hospital. Shall I say that the voice was deep, hollow, gelatinous, remote? Unearthly, inhuman, disembodied? What shall I say? It was the end of my experience, it's the end of my story. I heard it and knew no more. Heard it as I sat petrified in that unknown cemetery in the hollow, amidst the crumbling stones and the fallen tombs, the rank vegetation, and the miasmal vapors. Heard it well up from the innermost depths of that damnable open sepulchre as I watched amorphous, necrophagous shadows dance beneath an accursed waning moon. This is what it said.
You fool! Warren is dead!
Well, now, this one's a bit of a classic ghost story, isn't it? Goes to show that, provided that he managed to write a story about as few characters as possible, Lovecraft's actually pretty good at writing spooky horror. There's a strange sort of first draftiness to it, the regular reuse of the idea of the vaporous moon and the constant restating of the fact that it is a waning crescent moon, which I feel like that's meant to interface with the point that there he sees shadows that are not being cast by that moon. There's also a really interesting kind of desperate histrionics here. There is a vision of this cemetery as being old, like old as balls. But you got to remember, Lovecraft is writing about America in the 1900s, like early 1900s. So the actual narrative as she is presented is about a country that's 100 years old and a bit of change at that point. And so the notion of America having, you know, ancient sepulchres is really just more of that desperate Anglo-centrism, the notion that the ancient histories and the terrible, dreadful things lying in America could actually not be, for example, Native American mass graves. This is one of my favorite Lovecraft stories on its merit as a horror story, and the thing is, it's such a good template. You've probably heard a bunch of stories like it. The tool that's used to communicate probably changes over time, and the method does, but there are probably more than a few horror movies you've seen which more or less follow the template of this one's big shock. The whole thing's told in media re, so you have this conversation that you know that Carter survives, but you don't know how he survives. You also, in this one, you don't know what the threat is. You never will get to know. You do get to know that Harley Warren does lose his composure throughout it, which is, you know, that's a very common Lovecraftian thing. The idea that that good, stiff British upper lipness, which again, he was American, but this good idea of British resolve was capable of resisting the horrors of the world, and as the horrors of the world impacted you, your civilized manness was the thing that dissolved in face of it. If you can get past Lovecraft's desperate need for America to be an ancient country with an ancient history that doesn't necessarily involve non-white people, what you have here is a good, solid little ghost story that is in fact so good and so solid that over the past century and a half it has been more or less reiterated on endlessly. You probably already knew where this story was going the second you heard the opening, but this is one of the earliest places it showed up, and it's early enough that a telephone cable being laid was the technology being used. Neat, huh?